Right, I've been to this place, the Areopagus. It's amazing. This huge temple, right? And you look up at it, and what you get is Paul here speaking to three groups of people, at least three, but we'll just take three, and I'm pretty sure that most of us will fall in or at least understand who these people are. The first is the religious, and he says to the religious, you see that massive temple that you've just built up on the hill? And when you stand, we know the actual spot where Paul was, and you stand at that spot, and it's right behind you. It's massive. It's one of the most beautiful sites in the world, even as a ruin. And he says, you spent billions on it. You really have. And he said, you just wasted your money. It's like standing outside the Sydney Opera House and saying, yeah, sorry, guys, you wasted your money. Or at least you wasted the pokies' money. You know, it was an incredible nerve for him to say that. You know, it's like standing out the grandest cathedral or standing outside the Vatican and saying, look, you wasted your money because God doesn't live in a building. And then he spoke to two groups of people called the Epicureans and the Stoics. And you say, ah, I'm not interested in philosophy. Well, most people in Newcastle are Epicureans or Stoics. Why? Epicureans were the pleasure people. So they're the people who are saying, it's Sunday night, let's go party. It's Friday night, let's go party. It's Saturday night, let's go party. You know, so let's go eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And basically, Epicureans were pleasure seekers, and the Stoics were people who went, what's the point? Everything's a waste of time. You know, life's just a mess. Everything's pretty miserable, right? And I think most people I meet fit into, if there's a spectrum, they fit in that spectrum at some point. But Paul goes to them, and you'll notice what is said, that he was speaking the good news about the resurrection. Now, that was, again, some nerve, because the Epicureans didn't believe in life after death. Like, I suspect, most people in this city, they just didn't believe in life after death. And he points to Paul points to the proof of Jesus in some ways, in a different way. One of the churches he was at, well, it wasn't a church when he first went, he'd been to a place called Thessalonica. That's the one up in the north, Coffs Harbour equivalent. And there was a church formed, and he later wrote them a letter, and he says, they tell how you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. My hope and prayer is, if we're here next year, that there'll be people sitting in here going, do you know, a year ago on Easter, I was just out in the pub, or I wasn't even interested. I was serving other idols, and now I've come to serve Jesus. And that does happen, and we need to pray for that to happen. But the Epicureans didn't believe in life after death. And so they sneered. Now, the early church, there's a man called Augustine in North Africa. A lot of the early Christians, by the way, were Africans. And it's amazing just now how the church in Africa is growing. But Augustine said this, the leading truth the Christians profess is that Christ rose from the dead and first showed in his own flesh the immortality of the resurrection, which he promised should be ours. Now, a lot of Christians just go, yeah, Jesus rose from the dead. But you need to understand how much of a game changer that is. So I had a friend who came around to the house one time, and it was a book I'd written, and she's not a believer in any sense at all. And we had a conversation about the book, but the thing she said, the one question I have is this, do you really, really believe that Jesus is still alive? I said, why do you ask that? She said, because I don't believe that. She said, I think that's nonsense, but if it were true, it would change absolutely everything. And I said, you know, you understand a lot better than a lot of Christians. She was a very intelligent woman. I said, you're dead right. That is the absolute thing. So that's the question we're going to try and look at just now. Now, there's a man called Yaroslav Pelikan. What a great name. Yaroslav Pelikan. I think he was Serbian. I may be wrong. He said this, if Jesus Christ rose from the dead, nothing else matters. If Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead, nothing else matters. This really is the key thing. Did he rise from the dead? And forget all the stuff you hear at Easter about Easter bunnies and all the stuff you hear about, go out and be nice to people, and what a wonderful time of year, and all that kind of stuff, which it is, hot cross buns and everything else, just think of this question. Is Jesus still alive? So what would Paul say? So Paul is, you'll notice they do mock at him, and we'll look at that in a moment, but when they question him about it, they thought he was talking nonsense. You see what's said there, they began to debate with him. What is this babbler trying to say? He's a babbler. They thought he was advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Now, the word for the resurrection is a girl's name, Anastasia. And that was also the name of a god. And they were just thinking, okay, well where's all this coming from? What is this strange teaching? Well, I think Paul answers when people mock in this way. And I'll just give you the main points. First of all, he would say, I agree. You're absolutely right. Resurrections don't happen. See, there are some people who look back and say, well, in those days, resurrections happened all the time. Or at least people thought they did. They just didn't understand. But people weren't that daft. They didn't know. Resurrections don't happen. We don't have a graveyard. Where's the nearest graveyard to here? Is there a big council cemetery or something? What's it called? Sandgate. Yeah, okay, the Sandgate. I like walking around cemeteries. I'm sorry, that may be weird. Not because I'm into zombies or anything like that, but I really do like walking around cemeteries and just looking at the headstones and all that kind of stuff. And even the other day, there's a memorial garden there, and I hadn't done this before. I just walked around and looked at all the names in memory of so-and-so and so-and-so. There's something about that. You know, I don't know. I think there's something very profound about that. But here's the point. Supposing one of you died, and we took you and we buried you in the Sandgate. And then next week you're sitting here in the pew. That would freak everybody out. It would freak me out. I would resign. I wouldn't know what to do. I would just be, oh, you're kidding me. You're serious? You rose from the dead? Were you really dead? Is your twin brother, it's an hallucination? Am I in a dream? I would do all those things. It would be so hard to believe. Well, in first century Jerusalem, first century Athens, 21st century Newcastle, resurrections don't happen. It's not normal. So when you get all these Easter messages with people going, Easter is about the promise of spring and the flowers budding and the trees coming to life. No, that's normal. That's life. That's what happens. But resurrections are not normal. And if resurrections were normal, saying that Jesus was resurrected would be like saying Jesus was the Son of God because he recovered from illness, because he was sick and he got better. Well, in that case, an awful lot of you are gods then, because many of you have been sick and got better. I don't feel particularly well just now, and when I feel better tomorrow, hopefully, I'm not going to go around saying I am the Son of God because I feel better. No, Jesus. Resurrections don't happen. Number two, Jesus really died. There are some people think that he didn't die, that he was flogged, that he was nailed to a tree, he was stabbed in the side, he was covered in spices, he was wrapped up in a shroud, but he woke up and said, it was a bit of a tough deal, and pushed this giant stone away. Some people have even written songs about it. There's one, roll away your stone, I'll roll away mine, together we can see what we will find. So that's the kind of idea that if you have a stone, you have a problem in your life, what you can just do is you can just roll it away. And that's what Jesus did, and that's what we learned from Jesus. No. Jesus, he really died. And I think many of you will have seen a dead person. A lot of people won't have, because we hide from death. But when you see a dead person, I always remember taking a family and to see their dad who died, and he was at home, and they said, we want to see him before the coffin is closed. And I said, it's not a good idea. But they said, no, we want to go. And they were very upset when they saw him. And when they came down, they said, that wasn't our dad. And I said, no, you're right. It wasn't your dad. Death is such a horrendous thing. It's such a horrible thing. And Jesus really did die. He was really buried. A rich man called Joseph of Arimathea, aided by a Pharisee called Nicodemus, took the body of Jesus to his own cave tomb, a family tomb for wealthy people. He left it there after sealing it with a massive stone. Roman soldiers were put outside to guard it. You know, that was a really important thing because the ruling council, the Jewish ruling council, who were partially responsible for Jesus dying, they didn't want Jesus' disciples to come and steal the body. So the Roman soldiers were there and they guarded the tomb. Because Jesus had prophesied that he would rise from the dead and they knew the importance of it. Another thing is this. Paul would say, we've got eyewitness accounts of the resurrection. The Gospels. Now, Paul wasn't an eyewitness of the resurrection in one sense. He would have had the information that the Gospels contained, and he met the authors. Luke, for example, was one of his best mates. But here's the fascinating thing. The accounts of the resurrection came from women. And anyone who was here this morning would have heard that. And please, again, I say, I'm only reporting what happened. I'm not saying I agree with it, okay? This is where misunderstandings come in. Women's testimony was not considered valid in a court. Or if it was, you needed at least two women for every man in order to outweigh their testimony. Well, Luke has no qualms at all about saying this is what the women saw and this is what the women said. You'll notice later on in this passage that a woman named Damaris believes. All these witnesses, they all gave different accounts as well. And again, those of you who are thinking will go, hang on a minute, different accounts. Does that not mean they're all contradictory? No, think about it this way. There's a thing called the Muirhoff Doctrine. Now, this is in law. Now, I'll tell you what this is. Supposing you didn't like me, I realize these things are difficult to imagine, but supposing you didn't like me and you decided, right, we want to get him. So we're going to go and report him to the police. And one of you went and reported me to the police, and then another one went and said exactly the same thing. Exactly, word for word, the same thing. And another one said exactly the same thing. And another one said exactly the same thing. The police would have to look and have to go, no, this is made up because you do not have four witnesses who say exactly the same thing. They've obviously colluded together. On the other hand, let's say there was somebody who was guilty and witness A went and said this happened and witness B went and said this happened but described it in a different way and witness C went and described something similar but also different. The police would then take that very much into account. You have four witnesses giving four different accounts, but basically accusing them of the same thing. And that's what happens with the gospel accounts. Paul would have known there was a couple who were on the road to Emmaus. It's called a story in Luke chapter 24. And he would have known what happened to them when they met the risen Jesus. He traveled with Luke, and Luke was a doctor, but also a historian, so you really cannot get a better combination in terms of career if you're a doctor who's a historian, and then also an apostle who wrote. So Luke is one of my all-time heroes. And Luke carefully investigated. So in Luke 24, it says this, they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. He even knew what Jesus ate. The detail in all of this is quite astounding. So Paul would have said all of that. He also would have said, I've been to the tomb and it's empty. Paul would have said, I thought the body had been stolen. And I'll tell you why. Because my bosses, the chief priests, said that's what happened. And the Roman soldiers who they bribed said that's what happened. But Paul must have been a little bit suspicious because Roman soldiers didn't sleep on duty. You did, you were dead. So maybe they went to the wrong tomb, but then you could have produced the body from the real tomb. So Paul must have had some kind of niggle about that. But then he said, I know Jesus rose because I met the disciples. And I'll tell you what, I hated them. I hated Christians. I hated what he called the way. I was involved in the first killing when they stoned Stephen to death for preaching against them and for preaching Christ. I held their coats and I thought this was great. I get to go to a hanging or a stoning. And then I was freaked out because he died in such peace. And it bothered me so much, I thought, I've got to get the rest of these Christians before they get me. And he went off to persecute and to kill Christians. And it was on his way to do that, on the road to Damascus, that he met Christ. He said that. I met Jesus. All these people were committed, thought Paul, to a dead Lord, but he wasn't dead. And then he met him. And then other reasons he might give. We changed the Sabbath. Paul was really strict in his religion. Unlike the Jewish Sabbath, I think things like, some of the details like a Sabbath day's walk is like from here to the end of Bowman Street. He wouldn't walk any further than that. There were certain lots of things he wouldn't do. And that was the Saturday, and yet he changed. The Christians changed the day of worship from the Saturday to the Sunday, because every Sunday is Easter for us. At least it should be. Jesus is risen every Sunday. You know how you say on Easter, Christ is risen, he is risen indeed. Well, why not say that other times as well? He's risen next Sunday too, you know, and he's risen last Sunday as well. And then Paul would say this, I know that Jesus lives because we're still here. Because the church is growing and expanding everywhere. They keep telling us we're going to die. Augustine said this, and now we have three incredibles, all of which have yet to come to pass. It is incredible that Jesus Christ should have risen in the flesh and ascended with flesh into heaven. It is incredible that the world should have believed so incredible a thing. It is incredible that a very few men of mean birth and the lowest rank and no education should have been able to persuade the world and even of its learned men of so incredible a thing. See, it was largely the poor. It was largely the non-academic. Not all. Paul himself was very academic. Nicodemus was rich. There were people, some of the women who supported the church were rich women. But it largely appealed to the poor. In other words, if Paul was planting a church, he'd be more inclined to say, I think I need to go to South Hamilton than to Merriweather to start with. You know, it would be just a different way. Because that's just how it worked out. Now, the gospel is for everyone, but it particularly appealed to the poor. Bono, the Irish philosopher singer, that's how I'll call him, from U2, says this, I find it hard to accept that half the earth, millions and millions of people, have felt their lives touched and inspired by some nutter. That's what he's taught. And Jesus did rise from the dead. Now, I'm going to ask Terry, I missed out the wee video clip, and there's a video clip I want to show you. I was going to show this at the beginning, but I'm all over the place in one level. I was thinking of examples of resurrection in mainstream movies, right? So the one I like the most is Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, but you're already fed up of Lord of the Rings because I've mentioned it at least several times in the past two. So this one is from... it's from Narnia, and I think you'll reckon. I think C.S. Lewis, and I think the filmmakers were really faithful to the book, I think really gets it. So let's see, it's just a couple of minutes. Let's see this.
We should go.
Interpreted the deep magic differently. That when a willing victim who has committed no treachery is killed in a traitor's stead, the stone table will crack. And even death itself would turn backwards.
We sent the news that you were dead. Peter and Edmund will have gone to war. We have to help them.
We will, dear one. But not alone. Climb on my back. We have far to go and little time to get there. and you may want to cover your ears.
But I love that for lots and lots and lots of reasons. Not least that the two girls, the women going to the tomb, their surprise and their reaction, I think that captures beautifully how Mary and the other women would have felt when they saw Jesus. Plus, the stone cracking, you know, the temple curtain being torn in two. And then this wonderful line, and I just think this is just a brilliant line, the tide has turned. Easter tells us the tide has turned. And so those of you who are Christians, you've got to get hold of this, because you keep thinking, oh, the tide's coming in against Christianity. Oh, you got that so wrong. There's always been opposition to Christianity, but the tide turned with the resurrection of Christ. And after that, although we experience individual defeats, and although there are many bad things that happen, nonetheless, the victory is assured. So, let me just say something about the reaction, and then we'll sing. They do mock. You know, you see that right at the end. All the other stuff he said, they could live with that. But when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. And then Paul left. Some believed. One was a man called Dionysus, who was probably the equivalent of a senator. And the other was a woman named Damaris, who was certainly a basically, what's that woman, Rena Ryan, the one who owns all the, Rena, yeah, right, well, so that's the equivalent. Whoever that woman is in Newcastle, this is her going, no, I believe this. But most of them, this wasn't a very successful sermon by Paul, because most of them rejected it. And that's often what happens. So I do want us to think about our reaction to all these things. I love the song by the singer-songwriter Garth Hewitt, where he says, may you live to dance on your own grave, may you live to boogie all night long, which I just think is just a lovely expression. But I also think of this. I think of the heartbroken parents of a 27-year-old friend who had died. And it's the only time I've been in a mortuary. I was asked to go to the mortuary with them so they could identify the body, because his death was very sudden. And it was incredibly distressing. His body was there, but he wasn't there. And they could see that. And they knew that. But for them, the agony was this. He was a lovely, lovely believer. I mentioned the book Magnificent Obsession. I dedicated it to him. But his parents didn't understand. And you're looking and you think, that's it. That's the end. Finito. But everything in us says, no, that's not right. And that's because, as Ecclesiastes says, God has set eternity in the hearts of men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I think it's a wonderful thing that the resurrection gives us a future and a hope. We were talking this morning, I was talking to a friend about saying the prognosis for someone is not good. And it's not good. A Christian who's ill and who's dying. And the prognosis is not good. Except for the Christian, the final prognosis is very good. And it's always good. That's the answer to it all. So, we will sing this song. No, we won't. Sorry, I do want to read this poem. I do want to apply this in two ways. First of all, if you are a Christian, forgive me for saying this, but I almost envisage Jesus saying, why are you living as though I'm dead? Why am I just a memory? I am the resurrection and the life. Why are you so gloomy? Why don't you talk to me? Why do you act as though I don't see? Don't you know I will never leave you or forsake you, that where two or three are gathered in my name, that I am there in the midst? Don't you know that I have commanded you to go to all the nations? Don't you know I am alive And you need to tell people I am alive. And I think some of us as believers get very cowed by that. We say we believe, but we kind of believe on a Sunday. But what about tomorrow and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday? There's a real challenge. And believe you me, it is a challenge to me as well. But for those of you who are not believers, I think Jesus says this: why don't you come to me and have life? I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. Do you believe that? That's what he asked. Romans 10:8, what does it say? The word is near you. It's in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith we are proclaiming, that if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For it is with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it's with your mouth that you confess and are saved. That's an incredible thing to grasp. You confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. That's it. You don't need, you can't earn it in any other way. It really is as simple and as profound as that. But believe you me, when that happens, it's the most life-transforming thing that you will ever do. So let me just read this poem, or not the whole poem, part of it, by John Betjeman. It's called Three Crosses. I don't even know if Betjeman was a Christian, but this, he gets this so beautifully, so it makes me think he was. Three crosses stand upon a hill, so black against the sky and still, so still and black against the sky, the three of them, and we stand by. After the pain, the blessed relief. After the doubt, the firm belief. After the dark, the dread and sinister. The moment comes when angels minister. The sap is rising in the trees, a scent of spring is in the breeze. Good Friday passes, after gloom, Christ bursts in glory from the tomb. There's your three crosses, and amen to that, absolutely. There's your three crosses, the pain, the doubt, the dark. After the pain, the blessed relief. After the doubt, the firm belief. After the dark, the dread and sinister, the moment comes when angels minister, and they tell you, he's not here, he's risen. Good Friday passes, after gloom, Christ bursts in glory from the tomb. So we're going to sing about that, a song that was written about 1,000 years before Christ rose from the dead, but God inspired the Bible so that this is part of the Old Testament that looks forward to that. We're only going to sing part of it, Psalm 16, and you'll see as we sing it how it connects. Okay, we've got a little bit of time for questions or comments, and I do have my phone open, so if you want to do it that way, or if you just want to ask, I've got one to start with, which is a real, it's a big one, and it's just simply this, that some people say they've seen Jesus. How could I believe in him if I haven't seen him? Okay, now that's actually a fair point. That's not a daft question. Here's the problem, and maybe I can offer a solution. The problem is, if you said you'd seen Jesus, how would you know it was Jesus? You know, how do you know that the dream you had was a real dream? How do you know? So lots of people claim to be Jesus. You know, there's lots of people who are not very well, and they claim to be Jesus, but there are also people who are just fraudsters. And to be honest, religion is a great way to make money. So people can do that. But how can you trust what you see? I would say be very careful about that. Don't say I'm only going to believe stuff that I can see or touch, because you can be deluded and fooled by your senses. Now, we know this, don't we? Because of AI and photography. I mean, I can show you a photograph that shows me on the top of Mount Everest. It doesn't mean I've been on the top of Mount Everest, but there's a photograph of it. Surely that's proof. No, it's not proof. Not now. You know, you can even show movies of people that are AI generated that are fake, but they're so good, you're going to believe them. It's making our world a very confusing place. So that's on the negative side. On the positive side is this. Most of us believe things not because we've seen it all ourselves. So, I mean, I believe there's a place called Russia. I've never been there. I remember arguing once with a group of teenagers that Russia didn't exist, that it was just an invention of the American military-industrial complex, right? Well, you know, Russia, look, I can pretty well prove that Russia does exist. I can also say that all the planets in Star Trek definitely do not exist. And that really upsets Trekkies, right? But you can do stuff. We go by evidence. What is the evidence? And I would say this, you look for the evidence of Jesus, but there is one thing which is so different that really makes a home. So Paul, he went before King Agrippa and King Festus. He was on trial, right? He'd been arrested, again, charged with causing trouble. And he said, in the midst of his trial, he says, why do you think it's surprising that God would raise the dead? And Festus goes, Paul, you're insane. Your great learning has driven you mad. And Agrippa then went on to say, do you think you can persuade me to be a Christian in such a short time? And Paul says, not only you, but I wish that everybody here would be like me apart from the chains, because it's just so important. And here's how this happens. You examine the evidence, that's true. But you must have a degree of humility, because you or I cannot know everything. So we come with the evidence, we ask God to show us, and then at some point, what happens? It's kind of, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? At some point, we think we've got enough evidence that we say, right, Lord, I'm going to commit my life to you. And for some people, that is a spectacular blinding light experience. They just, the grass is greener, the sky is bluer. For other people, it's a very gradual thing. But I will say this, as I've gone on in life, I've had many doubts and many fears. And sometimes I think I can prove things, and other times I can't. But I know that Christ lives. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. We sang that this morning. But I know that he lives. And that's just one of the solid facts in my life. Sometimes there are other things I think are solid, and they're not so solid. But that is absolutely solid. So the way that you know this is through the Bible being the word of God, and God doesn't lie, but also through your own experience as you ask God, the Holy Spirit, to work in your life. If you're prepared to be open, see, here, we don't indoctrinate you. We don't manipulate you. We don't try and, you know, we don't argue. We don't bully you. We don't convert you. There isn't a single, if any Christian in Scotskirk or any Christian here from another church thinks that you can convert someone, well, you need to talk to me at the end, because we need to knock that out of you. Because I don't mean literally knock it out, but you know what I mean. We can't convert people. It's too big a deal. It's only God who brings new life. It's only the Holy Spirit. And that's why we believe in the Spirit. But the Spirit does work. That's the point. And here's the great promise. If you seek, you'll find. Okay? Simple as that. Right. Does anyone else have a comment or a question that you want to ask or say about any of this? Yeah, go for it. Yeah. It's a brilliant movie. And you know why? Because when C.S. Lewis wrote it, he wrote it as a story for children, but he also wrote it as a story to tell people about Jesus. And that's why it's such a good movie. And I'm so glad you really like it.
I like that. Jesus and the lion.
Yeah. Yeah. And the lion dies and the lion comes back to life. Do you know this? I've told this story to the others many times. You're a very wise woman.
Yeah,
I'll tell you why you're a wise woman, okay? Because there's a woman who writes, who's very clever and smart, and she writes for The Guardian. And when she saw that film, she said, I don't need someone to die for me. And I'm saying, yes, we do. So thank you. Bev, you were going to say something. Okay, tell us why. Yep. Empty tombs. Yep. So if you notice the windows, the stained glass windows, do you know this? I've been in this church for 4 months. I never even noticed that. Mind you, I'm nearly always facing this way. But with stained glass windows, that's exactly what it is. The resurrected Christ. The only thing that's wrong with that picture, does anyone know what's wrong with the picture of Jesus there? He wasn't white. He's a Palestinian. So he wouldn't have been white, okay? And I doubt he had blonde hair, but never mind. But anyway, that's Jesus. That's how people portray him. And the angels that portrayed there to telling them he's not here, okay? So yeah, thanks, Biv. That's great. Anyone else want to say anything before we finish?